The Superior Police Department received a mine-resistant ambush protected vehicle, or MRAP, several years ago, which has kept officers safe in dangerous situations. But now Superior is returning it to the Defense Department. Madison's Police Department is following suit. We're talking about it on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander said MRAPs are difficult to maintain, and then there is a public perception issue.
I heard from citizens that they didn't view it as an appropriate piece of equipment for the police department, that they thought we were overdoing things when we'd have that type of vehicle out.
WPR's Danielle Kading has been reporting on this from her base in Superior. Danny, welcome back.
Hi, Kate. How are you doing this morning? I like that you called it a base. I feel like I'm like organizing the rebels in Star Wars or something.
I like it too. It has a nice ring to it. Well, let's start out with Superior Mayor Jim Payne, who seems to be working through how to strike a balance between what his city needs to keep police safe and what might be overkill for the Superior Police Department. Let's hear a bit of what he told you.
I've generally supported the demilitarization of the police and ensuring that we have a community-based civilian police force that focuses on relationships, but also highly trained tactical and crisis intervention techniques so that we can de-escalate situations whenever possible, but are prepared for dangerous situations as well. So that was the spirit of getting the MRAP in the first place, protect police officers in sensitive emergencies or highly dangerous crises.
Okay, so there he's walking this line. How long has Superior had an MRAP, and what has it been used for?
I believe Superior has had its MRAP since about 2014. At least that's according to some documents that have been posted online by Open the Books. And it's been used for a number of things in the city. Generally, anytime there are hostage situations or if they're going on a search and seizure where they're making drug arrests and there's a high likelihood of guns or firearms being in a residence, or you know, when they're responding to possibly a report of a suspicious package where it might be an explosive device, they've used this vehicle to respond to those types of situations. Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander says they've used it only about like 6 to 10 times a year. But, you know, those 6 to 10 times that they do use it, it serves a purpose. It keeps their officers safe in what could become a violent situation. So they didn't want to get rid of it without having something to fill that gap.
And what will fill that gap?
Well, now the Superior City Council has approved the purchase of an emergency operations vehicle. Basically, they're downsizing to a smaller armored vehicle that will be a little bit more flexible and a little less massive, I guess. I mean, you see these mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicles, or the MRAPs, and they're very big. You know, they're very heavy, and they're designed to drive over improvised explosive devices or IEDs. You know, they're designed to take fire in a combat situation. So they're trying to get these vehicles that would allow to carry more police, you know, be a little bit more flexible for what they respond to and wouldn't cause so much wear and tear on property, because, you know, when they have used it, they try to get really close and sometimes they're parking it on people's lawns and that can really leave some damage behind. So,
and then there's also the upkeep of these vehicles, which you found is also of concern to the police departments.
Yeah. I mean, it's a military vehicle, so it's not like there's parts available just down the street. And that was something that Madison's assistant police chief, Vic Wall, had pointed out.
Well, Madison Police Department is returning its MRAP as well, citing challenges in that upkeep as a factor in its return. And let's listen to what Madison Assistant Chief of Police Victor Wall had to say.
You can't go down to the auto parts store and get spare parts for it, so as things break down or as there's issues with it, it becomes more and more challenging to keep it up and running and to maintain it.
So about the challenges in keeping it up, maintaining it, is that really the root issue here, or is there something else in returning these vehicles to the Defense Department?
It sounds like, you know, these agencies are making the decision to return it based on practical matters. You know, if it's costly for them to maintain, which they say it is, you know, if it's hard for them to get parts. Sometimes the Superior Police Department has had to fabricate parts because they haven't been able to easily find them. And sometimes these vehicles won't start up here in the cold weather that we have in northern Wisconsin. There's just a lot of challenges related to that. So I think they're making this decision for practical matters, but it also helps them to be able to downsize in the terms of public perception and how people view police when they're out responding to incidents in the community.
We're talking with WPR's Danielle Kading about a couple of police departments in Wisconsin that are returning their mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles, or MRAPs, to the Defense Department. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234, especially if you live in Madison and Superior. What do you make of the moves by your police departments to return vehicles on loan from the military? Is this a good thing or not so much? Does your local police department have military-grade equipment? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Danny, we have another clip here about the militarization of police that wasn't really a factor in Madison's situation. Here is Madison Assistant Chief of Police Victor Walligan.
The conversation about militarization of the police and, you know, armored vehicles seem to be a pretty convenient thing to bring into that discussion, but you know, our experience has been that it's really not that relevant.
So did you get a sense of this from anyone else you talked to for the story?
You know, I talked to several people, and it sounds like Madison and Superior are the only ones at this time that anyone's aware of that's returning their vehicles to this program. Under the National Defense Authorization Act, the military was authorized to transfer these vehicles to law enforcement agencies through the Law Enforcement Support Office, or the 1033 program. And so a number of agencies across the state have utilized this program or received these mine-resistant vehicles from the military, including Nina's Police Department, I believe Sawyer County has also received them.
And there are several dozen, right?
Yeah, there's 36 mine-resistant vehicles statewide. There's more than 600 that have been sent out to law enforcement across the country. So there's a lot of excess military equipment that's being passed out to law enforcement through this program.
Do you get a sense that there are other Wisconsin agencies that are in a similar place that they may be looking to downsize from these vehicles for similar reasons?
I think every agency makes decisions based on what's best for them, but it sounds like from talking with Jim Palmer, the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, that those agencies that are downsizing or are looking to move to a smaller armored vehicle are aware of the climate and views of police and the militarization of police right now, and that they want to be sensitive to that.
So what is the timeline for returning these vehicles?
So Superior is looking to purchase a new vehicle. They just received a $250,000 grant from the Wisconsin Department of Emergency Management. They're going to put that money towards a new vehicle, hopefully by the end of the year. I think Madison was hoping to have their MRAP replaced with what's called a Bearcat. They bought a used Bearcat from the Dane County Sheriff's Department, and I think they were hoping to have that up and running by now.
And so once these vehicles go back, then are they still able to participate in the 1033 program?
Yeah, they are. And, you know, I think the idea is that if they give these vehicles back to the program, that other law enforcement agencies might be able to access them. Because if you think about it, these vehicles are sometimes $500,000 or more. And if you're a small law enforcement agency looking for a specialized vehicle to respond to, you know, tense situations, it's going to be costly. And a lot of departments just don't have several hundred thousand dollars extra line around that they can put towards this piece of equipment. So this program has served a purpose because they've been able to get these vehicles on loan through the military. So they haven't had to do much of anything except for maintenance costs. And for these departments, those costs just prove to be a little bit too costly.
Well, Danny, thanks so much for getting us up to speed.
Yeah, thanks, Kate.
Danielle Kading is WPR's reporter in Superior. She joined us to look at recent news that police departments in Madison and Superior are returning vehicles loaned to them by the military. Next, we'll consider the state of militarization of police in this country with a guest, a criminal justice scholar. Getting your insights, your questions, 800-642-1234. Does your local police department have military-grade equipment? Do you think this makes you feel more safe? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Back after this news. The Defense Department has a program whereby it transfers excess military equipment to civilian police departments around the country. In recent days, we've learned that the Superior and Madison departments will be returning their mine-resistant military vehicles on loan from the Defense Department. We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The latest figures are that 8,000 law enforcement agencies have participated in this federal program with the Defense Department, transferring about $5 billion in military items over the past two decades. Let's bring in Peter Kraska to the conversation. He is the author of several books on the criminal justice system, editor of the book Militarizing the American Criminal Justice System, The Changing Roles of the Armed Forces and the Police. He's a professor in the School of Justice Studies at Eastern Kentucky University. Pete, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Well, so we've just heard that a couple Wisconsin police departments are returning their MRAPs. Is this a trend you're seeing, or is this unique? Are other police departments around the country making moves like this?
Well, we don't have any real data on the extent to which police departments are doing this. In terms of why they're doing it, what's motivating it, whether it might constitute a trend, it's hard to say. Certainly, I think a lot of police departments are sensitive to the police militarization critique, and they at least want to give the appearance that they're not a part of that. The extent to which, you know, this has become important news is interesting in terms of, you know, our police departments demilitarizing.
Well, when we talk about police militarization or demilitarizing, what are we talking about? Is it just equipment? What does militarization actually mean for police departments?
Yeah, without getting too technical, there's more to police militarization than just gear, military hardware. So that would constitute the material dimension of police militarization, which is important. But you also have a cultural dimension, you have an operational dimension, you have an organizational dimension. So there's more, certainly the gear is an essential element in police militarization, but there are other things. So just a quick example. Throughout the country, we've had for-profit warrior training going on, mostly done by military special operations trainers that have taught the police this mindset of, you know, shoot first, ask questions later, arm yourself as heavily as possible. You know, there's a tremendous infusion of military culture into modern day policing, and removing an MRAP is not going to impact that whatsoever.
So this culture you speak of is more about the specific tactical things police departments do, the actions that they take, not so much the equipment that they have stockpiled or you know, in place to be able to handle situations.
That's a great point, because you can have a lot of militarization. And in our early research, we had all kinds of indices of material militarization. In other words, they've been acquiring these goods from the military since the late 1980s. So this has been going on for a long time. But if that equipment just sat in a boneyard and wasn't used and wasn't brought out, and not, you know, the local police department didn't bring it to the basketball game and all the kinds of silly things that have happened, then it probably would be pretty inconsequential. But you're exactly right. It's the actions that go along with the gear that are important. So as soon as the police department says, you know what, we've got this gear, what are we going to do with it? And they have the bright idea of conducting 70,000 military special operations type raids inside people's homes for routine warrant work, then that becomes consequential.
How has the 1033 program influenced the culture of local police departments around the country?
I absolutely think it's had an impact. It's important to remember that police departments don't get most of their military gear from the military itself. Most of it they get from funds that they generate through civil asset forfeiture and the Department of Homeland Security. And so most of how they get these weapons is not from the military. That doesn't mean it's still not consequential. I mean, when you have literally hundreds of thousands of military bayonets going out to police departments, and these become a real collectible item among the police, and they really foster the sort of mentality of, wow, you know, I have a real live bayonet in my hand. There's nothing they can do with it, but it does start to create a cultural link of militarism between the military itself and the police. And the same is true with military weapons as well.
And when you say civil asset forfeiture, what do you mean by that?
So this civil asset forfeiture, again, has been going on since the late 1980s. It's incredibly popular. And it's where the police, very simplistically, there's a lot more to it, but the police go out into the community and they confiscate goods, but primarily cash. Mm. And the idea is to bring down drug kingpins. But unfortunately, the whole thing has devolved into mostly taking people's undocumented cash. And the average amount of money they take is not in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. The average amount of money they take off of people is about $200 to $300. And it ends up being really important because a lot of police departments across the United States of America are supplementing their budgets now by 40% with civil asset forfeiture. So in other words, policing now has a for-profit motive to go out into the community and extract resources beyond the tax base. And it's those slush funds that are created that help to pay for police militarization.
If you're just joining us, Pete Kraska is with us. He's the author of several books on the criminal justice system, editor of the book Militarizing the American Criminal Justice System, The Changing Roles of the Armed Forces and the Police. He's a professor in the School of Justice Studies at Eastern Kentucky University. You can join the conversation, 800-642-1234. Do you think police have become too militarized, or is this necessary for public safety? Are you a police officer? Have you noticed any changes in the past few years in the culture of police departments? What do you think, and what do your colleagues think about President Trump rolling back President Obama's ban on some military equipment for police departments? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Pete, what happens when a police force becomes more militarized? What are some of the real-world outcomes?
Well, one of the big things that happens is a police department starts to self-identify as something other than civilian police operating in a democracy. And so they start to think more in terms of stealth and secrecy and use of force, and filtering the incredible numbers of problems that the police have to deal with, filtering them through a lens of militarism, which means, how do we handle this problem? Well, our department tends to focus on the use of force and the threat of force as a way to handle community problems. So just a typical example, one small department that I worked with ended up with a whole bunch of extra money through civil asset forfeiture. They didn't know what to do with it, and they decided to buy 3 highly aggressive Rottweilers to patrol outside of high schools when the high schools let out, to provide what they called an aggressive presence for those high school students. That's the kind of mindset that is typical of a militarized police department, where they might be having problems after high school lets out, but their imaginations tend to be filtered through a lens of heavy weaponry and use of force.
Did that approach stand? Did they stick with it, or did they take those dogs back?
Oh, it's a great, nobody's ever asked me a follow-up question to that little anecdote. Actually, the dogs turned out to be an incredible hassle. And some of the community liked them, but they really weren't dogs that anybody could approach. And so in that small community, they ended up becoming really unpopular. And the chief of police backed down and wasn't able to return these $15,000 a piece animals. By the way, beautiful, beautiful dogs. Wasn't able to return them. And so they tried to give them to different officers, but they really weren't fit for family and home life.
Well, perception, that brings us to this issue of perception and what communities see of the gear, the vehicles, the dogs, because perception has implications, even that pressure that local police departments feel to make sure that they are still have a positive image in the community.
Yeah, the police in American society need to be approachable. They need to have an aura of responsiveness and good community members. I mean, that's sort of the hallmark of democratic policing. And it's an important question, the extent to which battle dress utilities, heavy weaponry, a certain mindset, if all of those things create a distance, a cultural and a cognitive dissonance between the police and the people that they're attempting to take care of and help out, it's problematic. And unfortunately, despite researching this for 35 years now, there are some people that are doing that exact kind of research. The impact that it has, specifically measurable impact it has on community perception.
Take us to police training. Does that have a role in developing a culture of militarization? And have you seen police training evolve over the decades?
Yeah, in fact, I was the first one to notice and really be alarmed by the dramatic change in police training throughout the 1990s and 2000s. Which culminated in the Washington Post and the New York Times running pieces that I helped them with, but they ran pieces that looked specifically at the whole warrior training industry, where you had certain individuals with military backgrounds that were going into policing and doing these very lucrative dog and pony shows and very popular to police officers. And this was going on literally for 2 decades before anybody noticed. And it put into officers a mindset, and they taught them this, that you don't know what's going to happen in an interaction with the civilian. And you're more likely to be killed before you pull the trigger, because that's how it occurs. So what you need to start doing is literally, and I'm not exaggerating, you need to assess the threat far earlier, pull the trigger far earlier, and unload your clip to eliminate the threat. And I don't have data for this, but I'm convinced that that ubiquitous training has had a significant impact on the rate and the extent of police killings in the United States.
Which it draws a thread, perhaps a through line that you see to Ferguson, Missouri, to you see even a movement of Black Lives Matter.
Absolutely. I mean, this killing of unarmed civilians, where an officer is extremely fearful of someone that's not armed, and they give them orders to stand down, to get on the ground, and of course, for mental health reasons or whatever is transpiring, the person doesn't immediately comply, or they're just angry and they don't immediately comply. I hate to harken back to the old days where police officers would get in scuffles with people, but the mindset now is, if I perceive a threat, I need to neutralize that threat. And that's a military mindset. And that absolutely comes directly from this larger trend of police militarization. And I don't think it's been acknowledged to the extent that it should be, because I really think it's an important driving force with what we're seeing today.
Let's bring in a call now. Philip is joining us from Jackson. Hi, Philip.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I guess my comment is that because we have criminalized products that have low intrinsic value and given them high extrinsic value, we have gone back to the days of the prohibition of alcohol, when we learned that it took great amounts of money to try to keep people from having something. And because we criminalized alcohol, the value went up so high that everybody who had low incomes and no incomes had to find a way to make money, and it was an easy way to make money. Now, today, we've authorized police to steal people's assets. And back then, we authorized people to steal and break up assets of alcohol. Today, you can go along and talk to anybody and steal $200 or $300 from them, and we can't. You know, and that's the way the police have to get money.
Philip, thanks for calling in with those thoughts. Philip, seeing a parallel to prohibition. Pete?
Well, it is interesting. I was testifying at the U.S. Senate about the 1033 program a couple of years ago. And a high-ranking member of the SWAT community talked to me afterwards, and he said, "Well, you know, Kraska, you know why this stuff has taken off?" And I said, "No, what's your perspective?" And he said, "Well, this stuff has taken off in terms of police militarization because of the drug raids. The drug raids were a way for SWAT teams to extract resources from people's private residences. In other words, to put more simply, they found it lucrative. And the extent to which that's true bears itself out in the data. But I think, as importantly as the caller said, we tend to forget the unintended consequences of our very punitive approach to things like drug control.
And we have to pause right there. Pete Kraska is with us, studies police forces and outfitted with military gear. Your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Back after this news. Back in 2015, President Obama banned the sale of certain military equipment to local police, including armored vehicles, grenade launchers, high-caliber weapons, and camouflage uniforms. The Trump administration has since rolled back the ban. In recent days, the police departments in Superior and Madison have said they're returning their mine-resistant vehicles to the Defense Department. There are 36 of these vehicles in Wisconsin. We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Eastern Kentucky University professor Pete Kraska stays with us. He edited the book Militarizing the American Criminal Justice System, the Changing Roles of the Armed Forces and the Police. Getting your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Does your local police department have military-grade equipment? Does this make you feel more safe, or is this a step too far for your community? Do you think police have become too militarized, or is this necessary for public safety? Call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Tona now, who joins us from Bayfield. Hi, Tona.
Hi, good morning. I was listening to the guest, and he was talking about feeling that communities, et cetera, want to, you know, take back the militarization, and they don't really want that and agree with that. And I'm wondering if they kind of went that way because of the amount of guns in our society per 100 people. It's like 88 per 100 people, and they have to treat those situations almost as if everybody has a gun. It's like the Wild West again. And I was thinking, if we don't reduce at least some of the guns in our society, I think that the officers are still going to be pretty psychologically very fearful in many situations.
Tona, thanks. Let's get Pete to respond.
It's a great point. I mean, we are in the midst of what I call the internal arms race. We have a population of people, a segment of the population that really wants to arm themselves, and they want to display those arms, and they want to go to protests carrying military gear, and of course it's not unreasonable for the police to say, well, we need to do that in kind. Now, which side started it first? You know, that's typical of any arms race. It's hard to pick. But that's certainly a dynamic at play now. I do have to say, though, historically, this was not motivated because because citizens were well armed. This was motivated out of the drug war of the 1990s, and it had very little to do, and statistically nothing to do, with policing being more dangerous for the police.
Well, last summer, President Trump overturned an Obama-era ban on certain military equipment for police departments. What did you make of President Obama's policy and of Trump's decision to overturn it?
So the whole situation was kind of surreal and sort of typical, I guess, of modern-day politics, where the Obama administration, you know, at post-Ferguson really felt like it needed to do something, so it put together various commissions. It ended up coming with 8 points that were going to demilitarize the police, mostly geared at the 1033 program. And those 8 points, as I mentioned in a lot of different outlets, really amounted to nothing. They didn't accomplish anything. They were all ineffectual. They said things like police departments can no longer have armored personnel carriers with tracks. Well, they never had them with tracks, and they didn't want them with tracks. So every 8 point was meaningless, literally. Then the Trump administration comes along and says, oh, we're going to remilitarize the police by doing away with those 8 points. Well, 8 points didn't do anything to begin with. Doing away with them wasn't going to accomplish anything either, but all of this made good political theater. I was a little disappointed at the extent to which the media sort of bought hook, line, and sinker without scrutinizing at all both the Obama administration's attempt to do something, and then the Trump administration. Both were really based on very little.
So did President Obama achieve any degree of demilitarization, or was it all just for gloss? Did you see any impact?
No impact whatsoever. Now, if there was any impact post-Ferguson, absolutely was a great awakening moment for the public and for some politicians. They really did say, hold it a second, on a lot of different criminal justice issues, including mass incarceration. They were saying, and police militarization, you know, what's going on here? Is this really what we want in this country? But all that political and cultural momentum that occurred post Ferguson really has dissipated, if not gone into the background now with the election of Donald Trump. By the way, that doesn't mean it's gone. It just means it's less visible and has less energy. I think it will crop back up inevitably at some point when some new crisis occurs or unfortunately.
Let's bring in Brent now, who joins us from Hebron. Hi, Brent.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm really amazed at this wonderful conversation. And I'm 68 years old. And when I was growing up, I built cars and stuff like that. But the police officers were gentlemen, and they were polite. And today is astounding with their aggressive behavior. And it goes beyond that, and it goes into the court systems who are depleting the poor that don't have money to get lawyers and stuff, and being fined outrageous for a thing called disorderly conduct and all this aggressive behavior towards the citizen is amazing. And I just want to thank this gentleman for coming out and speaking about it. Thank you very much.
Brent, thanks for the call. So Brent has seen an escalation of how police approach situations over the years.
Well, I really appreciate what Brent is saying, because I think what he's saying is accurate. But a real important caveat is that, you know, I work in and with the police institution. I absolutely am critical of trends like police militarization. But it's really important to remember that about half of the police institution really doesn't care for this, really would prefer something different. And we put in, you know, literally billions of dollars into trying to transform American policing into community policing. Now, militarized policing has ended up winning the day, unequivocally, no doubt about it. But that still doesn't mean that out of the 18,000 different police departments, you don't have a whole lot of police departments, maybe as high as 50%, that are really concerned with police militarization and would like to do something different. So it's complicated. You know, it's not, I don't want to just paint it all with a single brush, but unfortunately, when you have such a significant phenomenon, it's pretty easy to paint the entire police institution with the most pressing trends taking place.
Broad strokes, right. So as you look at those 18,000 police departments around the country, are there any departments that you'd point out that are balancing the situation best? Who is handling the situation right?
Well, I'm not sure, you know, they would even appreciate me naming them specifically, because believe it or not, the segment of the police community that tends to be more progressive, that tends to think things through more carefully, that has well-educated administrative staff that's concerned about these things, they're pretty quiet. And I'll get in a room of 500-600 police administrators, chiefs of police, captains, and I talk about all these things completely in a very candid way. And I'd say 40% of the audience is very supportive of what I'm saying, but they're also very quiet. It's the 20% of the audience that gets extremely upset with me and vocal with me, and they're the ones that tend to be the loudest.
Let's bring in John now in Three Lakes. Hi, John.
Hi. I'd just like to address like 3 points. The female that called two callers ago brought up the militarization of the police because of a gun issue. I was wondering if she's aware of what the gun laws are in France, and B, what happened in France last week and what the response was. And I'm also curious if she knows what the gun and knife laws are in the United Kingdom, and that they surpassed the United States for the murder rate. And you can't even get guns in Britain. So I think it's very common for your guests and many other people to blame militarization, et cetera, on guns. But, and I also heard him say that the police society and the last caller saying that the way that police operate has changed over time. And what I would ask him is, would he be the same person that says society has changed? You know, I think if we had a different conversation, he would tell you how much society has changed since he was a young person.
John, thank you. And I'm going to have Pete respond here because we're short on time. Pete, go ahead.
Well, it's absolutely true that the police are going to evolve as society evolves or devolves. We can't, though, make the argument that police militarization is just a rational reaction to changing social conditions. It's just not simply true. The police are bringing these changes forward and doing these kinds of things out of a whole slew of complicated reasons, and it's not just safety and protection of the American public. That's way too simplistic and way too much of a simple reaction to what's taking place.
Pete, we have to leave it here. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Pete Kraska is author of several books on the criminal justice system, editor of Militarizing the American Criminal Justice System, The Changing Roles of the Armed Forces and the Police. He's a professor in the School of Justice Studies at Eastern Kentucky University. Earlier, we spoke with WPR reporter Danielle Kading on the news that the Superior and Madison Police Departments will return their mine-resistant military vehicles to the Defense Department. This Hour of the Morning Show was produced by Breanne Shasso and Colleen Leahy. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. Michael Deringer provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.